Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Welcome to the latest global news, recorded at 16 hours GMT on Monday, the 29th of March. I'm James Menendez with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up, suicide bombers have carried out deadly attacks on the underground railway system in Moscow. This woman was leaving one of the railway stations at the time.
As soon as I got upstairs, I heard the blast, actually. I have no idea where it happened, but I definitely heard that.
Also in the podcast, a Chinese court has jailed four employees of the giant Rio Tinto mining firm on corruption charges. The Burmese opposition party led by Aung San Suu Kyi has decided not to take part in planned elections. And... do you think the sound of this ringtone could help you lose weight? We investigate later. But first... ambulances at Moscow's Lubyanka metro station, where this morning a female suicide bomber blew herself up during rush hour. It was part of a coordinated attack, and about 40 minutes later, a second female suicide bomber detonated the device she was carrying at Park Kulturi station. At least 37 people were killed. One of the bombs went off just as Yulia Shapovalova, a reporter for the cable news channel Russia Today, was leaving one of the stations. She described what happened.
I went to the Park Kulturi metro station, the red Sokolnichya line, and as soon as I got downstairs, the staff members started urgently evacuating people. So that meant probably that they knew about the first blast at the Lubyanka station. So what I remember, as soon as I got upstairs, I heard the blast, actually. I have no idea where it happened, but I definitely heard that. And I decided not to use the circle line, obviously. I decided to get out immediately, and I was surrounded by a huge crowd of people.
And the mayor of Moscow told reporters at the scene what he knew about the explosions.
It was a terrorist act carried out by female suicide bombers. This information comes from the Federal Security Service. It was specifically timed for the moment the train was nearing the station to do the most damage. The blasts were caused by 300 to 400 grams of explosives.
I then spoke to the BBC's correspondent in the Russian capital, Richard Galpin, and asked him whether the blame for the bombings was now being pointed at rebels from the North Caucasus.
Yeah, absolutely, explicitly. You know, we've had the head of the main intelligence agency, the FSB, saying that he believes that the two female suicide bombers were connected to militants from the predominantly Muslim region of the North Caucasus of southern Russia. So we now have an explicit link being made.
And what do those rebels want? Just give us the context.
Well, essentially, you're talking about areas such as Chechnya, Ingushetia, Dagestan, who for many years have had a rebellion fighting for independence, fighting against Russian rule. And, you know, one interesting thing, we have found a video posted on the internet just last month by a man claiming to be the self-proclaimed leader of those militant groups, a man called Doku Umarov, in which he explicitly threatens that their operations will be expanded into mainland Russia, saying that attacks would be carried out in towns and cities. So, as he put it, Russian people would understand that the conflict in the Caucasus was not just something which they watch on television. So it seems that there had been an explicit warning from the militant groups that they were planning operations beyond the North Caucasus region.
And there had been a series of attacks in Moscow, similar attacks by similar groups, but not for some years.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There'd been a whole series from around about the year 2000 up until 2004, which is, of course, at the time when the second Chechen war was underway. There were bomb attacks in the metro, near metro stations, on Red Square. Two airliners were brought down, it's believed, by female suicide bombers. So there was a whole spate of attacks in which many, many people were killed and injured. But they stopped in 2004. Having said that, there was one other very clear and important warning signal back in November last year when the main railway line between Moscow and St. Petersburg was bombed and more than 20 people were killed in that. And at that time, the authorities quite explicitly said that they believed it was the work of an Islamist militant from the North Caucasus region.
Richard Galpin in Moscow. A court in Shanghai has jailed four employees of the Anglo-Australian mining giant Rio Tinto for up to 14 years. All were found guilty of bribery and stealing trade secrets in a case that's caused alarm among foreign investors. The most prominent defendant, an Australian citizen, Stern Hu, was jailed for 10 years. Australia criticised the secrecy surrounding parts of the trial and what it called a very tough sentence. Rio Tinto reacted to the sentences by sacking the four and saying it hoped their behaviour wouldn't affect its future relationship with China. Dan Damon asked the BBC's Damien Grammaticus in Shanghai what was the likelihood that there would be an appeal and that the sentences would be reduced.
Well, at the minute, no indication at all that these men could appeal. They have 2 days to do so. But as you were just hearing, the implicit feeling is that the sentences they received very harsh, ranging between 7 and 14 years, 10 years for the Australian national Stern Hu. And that despite the fact that the men had admitted some of the bribery charges and apparently cooperated, which they might have expected to give them or earn them some leniency. The judge actually said he thought he was being lenient, interestingly.
And the Australian diplomats very upset that they weren't given access to these hearings.
Yeah, they were given access to half of it, the portion of the trial that dealt with the bribery claims, the portion of the trial that dealt with commercial secrets, stealing commercial secrets that everybody was shut out from, the diplomats, journalists. So we were not allowed in anything except for the final verdict and then only on a video link. But it does appear, or there has been suggestions that the fact that the diplomats were not allowed in some of the trial was contrary to consular agreements with China, and Australia could perhaps feel aggrieved because of that.
And do we know anything about the evidence then that brought about these, as the Foreign Minister of Australia says, harsh sentences?
Very, very little, and that is part of the problem with this. There was some indications given during the sentencing where the judge read out this huge long list of sums of money that the men were said to have received from Chinese steel firms, including private steel firms, trying to encourage them to give business and iron ore contracts to the private firms at the expense of the Chinese state firms. But as for the actual evidence about those sums and the evidence, more importantly, about the commercial secrets allegations, none of that at all was open to observers. And particularly on the commercial secrets issue, that is a real cause for concern for foreign businesses here who've been watching this trial. I've been told that businesses are very worried because they say, we don't know what information has been deemed sensitive, what might land other businesses in jail for handling, because we're not able to see the evidence and the process of this trial.
Damien Grammaticus in Shanghai. Burma's main opposition party has ended weeks of uncertainty by announcing that it won't run in elections later this year. The military authorities have previously barred the party's leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, from standing in the poll, which will be the first held since 1990. From neighbouring Bangkok, Rachel Harvey reports.
Aung San Suu Kyi made it clear last week that she was opposed to her party participating in the elections, but she said the final decision must rest with the NLD as a whole. So the confirmation that Burma's main opposition party will not run is no real surprise. New election laws bar anyone with a criminal record from being members of a political party. Since Aung San Suu Kyi has been in some form of detention for most of the past 2 decades, the NLD was faced with a stark choice: expel their charismatic leader or boycott the election. The party has chosen the latter, which also means that legally it now has to disband. The United Nations Secretary-General has previously expressed concern that conditions in Burma do not measure up to what is needed for an inclusive political process. Today's decisions will have done nothing to ease those concerns.
Rachel Harvey reporting. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. And don't forget, if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Now, the Japanese Foreign Minister Katsuya Okada has arrived in Washington for a meeting with the American Defense Secretary Robert Gates. Japan and the United States are trying to resolve a dispute about an American military base on the Japanese island of Okinawa that's cast a shadow over their alliance. Plans to move Futenma Air Base to another site on the island have provoked a strong local reaction. They've shaken the politics of Japan and now threaten America's most important military alliance in Asia. As Alistair Leith had now reports.
Every day at 8 a.m. here on Okinawa Island, the Japanese and American flags are raised together. Both anthems are played as the Stars and Stripes and the Rising Sun fly side by side. The two countries made a deal 60 years ago in the aftermath of war, but now there are rumblings over that agreement. There are nearly 50,000 US troops based in Japan and a lot of aircraft. For decades, America has provided Japan's defense in exchange for a strategic US base. Japan's even been described as America's unsinkable aircraft carrier. I'm walking through the Peace Park on Okinawa Island, a memorial to all those people who died during the Second World War. 12,500 American troops were killed here, and on the Japanese side it was nearer 200,000, with half of them being civilians. All their names are inscribed on granite slabs. The people of Okinawa suffered greatly during the Second World War, and today they say they're shouldering more than their share of the burden for hosting American forces. Three-quarters of the U.S. facilities in Japan are based on their island. But it's not just a local dispute. There's a new government in Japan promising change and a more equal relationship with the United States.
We also share the objective of a more equal alliance partnership. It's not an equal treaty.
Raymond Green is the U.S. Consul General in Okinawa, and he defends the U.S. presence.
I think it's an incredibly stabilizing factor. Asia is going through a period of historic strategic change in the balance of power. We have the missile and nuclear programs in North Korea. Obviously, the rise of China is something that we all welcome, but as it rises economically, there's also many questions about the military modernization program and the transparency, or lack thereof, that has gone along with that.
The voices of protest are being heard.
Okinawan people do not need American base.
It will destroy the environment for the future generation. So we should get together, I think, to let them leave.
The focus is plans for Futenma Air Base. The previous government agreed to relocate it to another part of Okinawa, but a new prime minister was elected promising to move it off the island. He's now caught between keeping his promise and a domestic political coalition together and managing relations with America. At the end of one runway is a school playground. This used to be fields, but the city has grown around the base and most people now agree it should be moved. Muneo Nakamura is the deputy head. He complains about the aircraft noise and says a helicopter crashed near the base 5 years ago, and every day they're afraid it could happen again. The U.S. Marines argued they've changed the rules to improve safety, and there have been no accidents since.
Our Marines, we have a felony traffic stop we're going to hit up right now.
A SWAT armed response team is training on a U.S. base.
Military police! Military police!
Practicing pulling a suspect from a car.
Hey, overall, I mean, that looks really good.
Assessing the exercise is Gunnery Sergeant Brian Dye. He's lived in Japan with his family for 3 years. Some locals say they're tired of the U.S. presence here. A high-profile rape case in 1995 tarnished their image, and the troops do bring some crime to the island.
Certainly understand that. I try to think of it, you know, if we had troops stationed on, you know, U.S. soil, what would our reaction be? But I will say that as long as the Japanese government and the United States government feel it's in, I guess, both of their interests, then we'll probably remain in some form or fashion over here.
The curious sights and sounds of a St. Patrick's Day parade through the streets of Okinawa City.
A few bemused older Japanese people negotiate their bikes through the costumed troops spilling out from the bar. But there's a strong Japanese influence to the party too. A kids' karate demonstration. It's a strange blend of cultures. In many parts of this island, you could easily be in America. The relationship the two countries have is too important to collapse, but it will take careful political and diplomatic footing to stay on track.
Alistair Leithhead on the island of Okinawa. A court in the United Arab Emirates has sentenced 17 Indian nationals to death for killing a Pakistani man in a dispute over control of an illegal alcohol business. It's thought to be the highest number of death sentences handed down at one time in the Emirates. Electra Naismith reports from Islamabad.
Around 50 people were involved in the attack, stabbing their victim repeatedly and beating him with iron bars. DNA tests singled out 17 of them as having been directly involved in the killing. They've now been sentenced to death. The attack is said to have been the result of a turf war over the sale of illegal alcohol. Unlike in Dubai, where the sale of liquor is loosely regulated, the Emirate of Sharjah operates a total ban, creating a climate in which gang violence connected to illicit alcohol and its production is on the increase.
Electra Naismith in Islamabad. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been visiting Turkey. Almost 3 million Turks live in Germany and both countries have strong trade ties. But there are several issues on which Turkey and Germany don't quite see eye to eye, not least Turkey's bid to become a fully-fledged member of the European Union. Mrs. Merkel opposes full EU membership for Turkey and has come up with an alternative plan. But as Jonathan Head reports from Istanbul, the proposals left some Turks feeling very angry indeed.
Turkey's sometimes fraught relationship with the European Union won't be helped by this visit. After months of avoiding the subject, Chancellor Merkel has chosen this moment to revive her idea of offering Turkey what she calls a privileged partnership with the EU rather than full membership. In interviews before her visit, Mrs. Merkel has stressed that she does see integration as possible in up to 28 of the 35 so-called chapters of EU law with which Turkey has to comply before it can become a full member of the Union. But her proposal has been firmly rejected by the Turkish government as a breach of the terms agreed when membership negotiations began 5 years ago. Egemen Bağış is the Turkish Minister for European Affairs.
Such a thing as privileged partnership does not exist. So we do not take that option seriously because there's no legal foundation of it. At times, I feel insulted for being offered something which doesn't exist.
The Chancellor does have plenty of other topics to discuss here. The two countries have deep historic ties. Germany is Turkey's biggest trading partner, and nearly 3 million Turks live in Germany. Mrs. Merkel also plans to raise Iran's nuclear program with her Turkish hosts. Turkey has recently strengthened its relations with Iran and opposes the tougher sanctions threatened by Western governments. But their differences over EU membership will cast a shadow over any common ground they do find during this visit.
Jonathan Head in Istanbul. Now, you're probably aware that mobile phones these days can do a great deal more than just make phone calls. They can send emails for you, take photographs, tell you where you are. And now it's claimed they can even make you feel better. If you suffer from hay fever, for example, listen to this. That's a ringtone that it's claimed can help cure you of hay fever. What about this one? And that supposedly can help you lose weight. Robin Lustig spoke to the technology journalist Adrian Mars and asked him if he believed any of these claims.
Not a word of it. And there isn't any science to back it up. The best we've got is a quote from the guys who are selling this, which is, while there is a shortage of actual experimentation, the number of downloads suggests the ringtones must be working to a certain extent. Well, let's throw away science. We've been going wrong all these years, ever since the Enlightenment. We should have been using download charts. How stupid could we be?
Okay, but just a second. People are buying them. People are buying ringtones by their million. Why?
Well, I don't. Most of them, of course, aren't therapeutic, and most of them are bought by the young, and they're all part of defining your identity. It's all part of, you know, saying who you are, and that's playing a little, usually a little burst of music that says what sort of music you're interested in, just as the youth are very keen to sort of allay themselves to a group, work out what sort of person they're being. You see it with clothes, you see it with the type of phone they're using, you see it with the type of personal hygiene products they buy. They want to be part of the group, and it's part of that. In older people, usually it's about being inconspicuous. Either they'll have the default ringtone, which usually means they don't know how to use their phone, and that every time
that's
I hear
not
that,
fair. My phone has a default ringtone. When it rings, it sounds like a telephone ringing.
Exactly. That's the other thing. That's what most older people want. They want to be inconspicuous. So either if you hear the hideous Nokia tune, that usually means it's somebody who's unfortunately been saddled with an unpleasant default and they don't know how to change it. But everybody else, beyond teenagers, usually chooses something fairly innocuous, like a plain, ordinary ring.
It's a huge business, though, isn't it? I mean, people are making a lot of money out of selling these things.
Absolutely, and the record industry is making quite a bit of money.
Oh, what, because some people choose tunes as ringtones?
And the absurd thing is, really, you can usually make your own ringtone. There's lots of ways to do it.
You are not going to buy a ringtone to cure your cold, your hangover, your headache, whatever?
I don't think so. There's ones for weight loss. There's ones that are meant to wake you up, which sound like... And one rather lullaby one to send you to sleep. That's about the most convincing thing. But if I want something to send me to sleep, I'll just download a lullaby, I think.
The technology journalist Adrian Mars there. Well, that's all from us for now. An updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download in 12 hours' time. I'm James Menendez. Until the next time, goodbye.